Welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and we are broadcasting from the UC Irvine campus in Orange County, California. You can also listen to podcasts of the show on iTunes and Stitcher. And today, my guest is Courtney Maugham, the author of the novels Costalegre, a Goop book club pick, and one of Glamour magazine's top books of the decade. I'm having so much fun here without you, and Touch, a New York Times Editor's Choice and NPR Best Book of the Year selection. Her writing has been widely published in such outlets as the New York Times, O, the Oprah Magazine, and Poets and Writers. And she's here today to primarily talk about the handbook Before and After the Book Deal, A Writer's Guide to Finishing, Publishing, Promoting, and Surviving Your First Book from Catapult. Welcome to the show, Courtney.
Thank you so much for having me, Barbara.
It's great to talk to you finally. We've been trying to connect during these days of COVID-19.
A lot has changed, indeed.
you were in Mexico for a while, I recall, because you were going to be on, and you said you were stuck in Mexico.
Yeah, that was a funny story. So Costalegre, my third novel, it takes place in Western Mexico, and the book this winter came out in Spanish in Mexico with a publisher who's already published me. So I was going on a little bit of a press jaunt, and I brought my husband and my young daughter, and we started off in Mexico City. This was the beginning of March, the first days of March. And, you know, basically day part, it became clear that, this COVID was very, very serious. And we were faced with the decision whether to, you know, rush back to America or stay in Mexico. And by the time this all happened, we were in such a rural area called Correas in the state of Jalisco, where the Costalegre takes place. It would have taken 4 or 5 planes to get home, and things were really, really bad back where I live in Connecticut, and so on and so forth. So we stayed with a family friend in the jungle, where my book takes place, for 2 months. And of course, Costalegre is about a bunch of surrealist artists in isolation during a war. So it was a very weird meta experience. I lived inside of my own novel for 6 weeks instead of promoting it on the road. So that's where I was.
Oh God. And then how was it getting back? Was it troublesome?
It wasn't at all. Not that I want to recommend flying on air, but I will say, I think we came back at the right time. They had sort of just opened flights again, and we waited until, you know, we only had to take 2 planes back. And I mean, it was just, you just can't imagine, you know, it really is like something out of a science fiction novel. I was more impressed with the way they handled the security in Mexico. Even on the road, there were roadblocks to make sure that we were wearing our masks as we got closer and closer to Puerto Vallarta, which is the commercial airport that we flew out of. And then inside of the airport, this was on May 4th, I think, is when we returned. Mm-hmm. There were checkpoints every, I don't know, let's say, you know, quarter mile, I don't know what distance exactly, but at every important part of the journey, before check-in, before security, right after security, you know, they would take your temperature. Right before we got on the plane, they did sort of a full body check and took our temperature. And then we got to Chicago, and there was just nothing, nobody. We had no interactions with anyone. And it was so odd. We had to go through customs in Chicago. And for anyone listening who's been through Chicago, I mean, you're usually an hour and a half in that customs line. There was no one in line. And then at customs, the woman said, oh, you've been gone 2 months. And we sort of steeled ourselves for a whole diatribe about why we had been in Mexico so long. But my husband just said, yes. And she said, okay, and stamped us, and off we went. And that was it. No temperature control, no questions. It was a bit disconcerting. And then we had a beautiful surprise upon our arrival in Hartford. One thing I'd been really worried about is, I had flown to Mexico separately because I was on book tour in Texas, and my husband and daughter were leaving at 4 a.m. from Connecticut, and they ordered a taxi that never came because it was daylight savings back in March. And the fellow overslept. So you know, I remember that phone call very well when he called me in Texas and said, oh, I ended up having to drive. And I thought, oh man, you know, we'd been planning to be gone 3 weeks. That's going to be kind of an expensive airport parking fee. And it was 2 months. Our car was stuck. And so we've both been thinking, oh my God, this unexpected cost of this dumb car in the airport parking terminal. And when we got to the airport in Hartford, the woman said, you know, there's no shuttles, there's no hotel shuttles, there's no airport shuttles, there's nothing. She said, okay, I have good news and bad news. The bad news is the taxi, you know, it's a minute ride. And she said, it's going to be $18. But the good news is the parking garage is open and you just drive out. You know, there's no cost. And we thought, yes, oh God, thank God. So it was a journey.
Yeah. Wow. Material, right?
Yeah, sure.
For some future time.
No shortage of material right now.
Well, I heard you on line yesterday. The Authors Guild did a, for those of you who did not see it or hear about it, the Authors Guild did a webinar with Courtney. And it was so interesting listening to that and watching that before today. And before we get into the book, talking about before and after the book deal, I have to talk about the fact that you don't have an MFA. Mm-hmm. And you have published all the stuff and keep going with it and keep having success. And this will be entirely motivating to people listening who either do not have an MFA or, you know, are berating themselves thinking they must get one. Will you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. And I mean, I think it's important to say that, you know, I don't have an MFA, so I cannot speak about having an MFA. You know, I can conjecture or whatnot, but I don't want to say that my way is the right way because I didn't do the other way. I will say, I mean, I think I majored in college, I majored in comparative literature and translation. So I think already not majoring in English helped me be comfortable with thinking from a relatively young age about how I could nurture my love of writing and reading and also make some money in a way that didn't have to do with teaching, I guess, you know. So comparative literature, you're looking at the way that film and art and writing affects literature, really, and politics and whatnot. And honestly, it didn't seem like it at the time, but it set me up quite well for the work that I've been doing for 20 years in sort of marketing, branding, and trend forecasting, just learning to think in a compare and contrast way across many different categories was interesting. So already, you know, after college, I moved to France to work in translation and some other fields. So getting away from America helped because I wasn't surrounded by, I didn't do writing workshops and whatnot in college. I took some poetry writing classes, but I wasn't, I don't know, part of the scene. I was sort of just writing for myself and giving terrible poems to boyfriends and, you know, and so, I mean, I lived in France for 6 years. By the time I had a novel ready and did secure an agent, we found an editor for it quite quickly. And so it just seemed like, well, I'm going to make it without this MFA step. And, you know, didn't realize I was supposed to have one, but I looked around and it was started to be clear from people's bios that everyone had one. So I thought, this is great. I've skipped that step. No problem. Well, that book, the editor ended up dropping the book and it didn't get published for 10 years. So there was a period between my sort of in my late 20s where by that time we'd moved back to America and I thought, I did think about the MFA. At that point, we were living in the Berkshires of Massachusetts, really rural area. I had no friends. I had no writing friends, I should say. I had friends. I had no writing friends. I had no mentors. If someone had asked me for a blurb, I would have had to ask my high school teacher, you know? So when I was thinking about whether or not to apply for an MFA at the, you know, ancient age of 28 or something, I thought, do I want to spend this much money and potentially uproot myself to make friends? Because that's what, I mean, I figured, you know, I could take online writing classes or I could read, I could give myself, I could sort of auto-manage my own MFA. But I thought, is it worth this much money to make contacts in the industry, because that's what it seems like I'm missing. And I didn't really have to decide, because I got a phone call from like a talent management company who asked me to interview for a corporate naming job in Manhattan, mm-hmm. Where I would be naming companies and brands and things. And I did not live in New York. You know, we were living in the Berkshires, but I decided to take that job on, I think it was like a limited contract. I told them I'd do it for 7 months, part-time, four days, three nights a week, so that I could still come back to, you know, my life in Massachusetts. And what I did, and I wrote about this for Tin House, it's still online, I think, I set up a mini MFA program for myself. And the way it worked was I vowed that I would attend one reading series for every single night I was in New York. And that while I was at that reading series, I had to introduce myself by shaking hands, back in the time when we could shake hands with strangers, to one person while there. And I did that without fail, never missed a night for about 3 months, a little over 3 months straight. And the beautiful thing about New York is that at first, the literary scene, at first it seems so intimidating. But really, it's the same circle of about 30 people going to all the parties. So honestly, by the end of 2.5 weeks, I sort of met the movers and shakers and the editors and whatnot. And I think people just assumed that I was some new MFA student on the block. And shortly I was getting asked, like, would you like to read at this series? Do you have anything, you know, that you could send us? And all of a sudden, I was meeting the people on the mastheads, you know, who had been rejecting me for so long, but now they knew me. So even if they were going to reject my work, which they did, they would give me feedback because we knew mm-hmm. each other, you know, and they were kind enough. And this is my very long-winded way of saying mm-hmm. that if you are an outgoing person and very self-driven and have the possibility to get yourself to an urban area, you might be just fine by getting a job, you know, and saving up, well, just saving some money and going to the reading series and volunteering to read for a magazine and joining a writer's workshop and going to bookstore events and being part of stuff that way and actually meeting people. If that feels right to you, if you're someone who is a bit shy, introverted, really needs to be shooken up by being around other writers and having some amazing teachers, and you can go without, you know, income really for 2 years and also face a limited job market when you come out, why not? And if someone else is going to pay for your MFA, go, you know, why wouldn't you? But if it's going to create a huge dent in your finances right now, I don't know that this is the time to go do an MFA. You know, I mean, we don't even know if there'll be higher education, right? So, you know, getting an MFA to then go teach, I don't know. I would think twice if you can't afford it. If you can easily afford it, off you go, sure. I mean, but there's a lot to be said for just getting yourself out there and being social and making those connections and forcing yourself to read and write. And I have to say, I really do believe in online classes. I've taught for Catapult. I've been a student at Gotham Writers Workshop and Grub Street, and you know, there's Sackett Street. There's so many incredible online classes. And especially right now, I mean, the quality of instructors you can have is sort of berserk. It's like wild, you know?
Yeah, I agree. I'm also just curious in terms of your view, especially after writing the book, what your view is in terms of agents. Do you think agents are concerned with writers having MFAs? Is that something they're going to look at and pay attention to in a query letter, or mm-hmm. or maybe, you know, decide they're not interested because you're not an MFA graduate?
Well, let's see. My agent, I've had three, and no one I ever balked at the fact that I didn't have an MFA. It never even came up. So for me, no one gave a hoot, you know, because I had a lot of bylines. I was active in the mm-hmm. literary world. I think that agents start to balk when you have no published bylaw, you know, when you send a query letter, let's say it's four paragraphs, right? You've got sort of the summary of the book, and then toward the end, you start getting into your bio. If your bio has nothing, you know, it's just basically like, let's say I'm a physical therapist and this is my first novel, they'll have some questions, right? I think, you know, it would behoove someone with absolutely no connection to the literary world to go to a summer writer's workshop or enroll in an online class so that you could put on your bio that you're actively starting to become part of the literary world. Again, volunteering to be a reader for a literary magazine is a fantastic idea. You can also volunteer for, there's so many great nonprofits out there. Authors Guild, Penn, the National Book Foundation. There's so many ways to get involved. You know, you won't be paid, but you'll meet these incredible people and have great connections. So I do think that agents want to see that you're involved in the literary world some way. And that just proves that, you know, you're sort of hip to the conversations that are taking place. You know what the hot topics are. You can be put on a podcast and just sort of be with it. Do you know what I mean? Whereas mm-hmm. if you're coming out of left field, there's some schooling that needs to happen. And also, and this is no small thing, if you say that you've been in an MFA or you went to, I don't know, the Tin House Summer Writers Workshop or something, the agent will know that you have been in a situation where you've been critiqued, where you have received feedback. Mm-hmm. I do think an agent will balk at someone who's never received feedback for their work, because obviously a huge part of getting a book published is working with editors who ultimately probably not want to make your book shorter, and you're going to have a lot of words cut, and they need to know how you're going to handle that, right? So, but I think the nice thing about America, this is not always the case in some other countries, but, you know, I do think that we remain a culture that is willing to give anyone, you know, their first shot. So I don't think that it's that hierarchical. I don't think that for teaching, it's different, right? If you're applying for a teaching job, they're going to want to see an MFA on your resume. But not, I mean, it's all about the voice and the promise of your story and your platform and all of that. So I don't think it matters, but you have to show something. You have to show that you have skin in the game,
right?
Somehow.
And what you're also talking about, it's something I talk about with my students. I teach at Gotham as well, yes. as mentioning that wonderful place. But I talk a lot about being a good literary citizen.
Yeah,
and absolutely. A lot of what you're saying is just that, you know, getting involved, going to readings, meeting people, things that, especially for introverts, might be hard to do. But in the end, I mean, like, I started this show such a long time ago, and part of it was designing my own MFA program.
Yeah.
I had a little boy, and it's like, okay, how can I get out there more? How can I meet writers? How can I, you know, get involved? And there's all kinds of ways to do it, as you say, and important. It's important to do.
It is important to do. And I think for people who are a bit shy or introverted, one way to think about, you know, a period of like literary citizenship immersion is to think about it as a free training program, because yeah. if your dream comes true and you get published, you're not going to be allowed to be silent in your office while your book's coming out. You know, the goal for most people, the outward signs of success are that you get sent on some level of a tour, even if it's virtual. You right. know, you're doing the Zoom calls, you're speaking about your book, you're giving interviews, you're going on to podcasts. If it's really successful, you're doing television. And that doesn't happen overnight. That takes years, years. I remember doing an interview this year for my fourth book where I just thought, I understand how to talk about my work now. Mm-hmm. You know, and it takes a really long time because you have to go through years of those totally awkward conversations where someone important asks you what your book's about, and 27 minutes later they've, you know, fallen asleep under the table because you don't have a log line. Mm-hmm. I have a story in my book of a writer who had, you know, a dream opportunity. He was on NPR to talk about his book, and he didn't know this was coming. And the host, Lulu Navarro, said, okay, in 20 seconds or less, summarize your book, which his book was 600 pages. And he just stalled, you know, and you don't want that to happen on NPR. You want that to happen at some crappy party at AWP, you know, where you're spilling beer on someone, and you work those not kinks out before it counts. And so that's why I think, even if you're shy and it makes you want to, you know, die speaking to people you don't know very well, better to do it in the 2 years leading up to your potential debut than, you know, choking on air with Terry Gross, right?
And you should be so lucky, right?
Well, yes, one should be so lucky.
And then you can't get it out. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. You're listening to Writers on Writing, and I'm with Courtney Mom. Her book is called Before and After the Book Deal, A Writer's Guide to Finishing, Publishing, Promoting, and Surviving Your First Book. And it's published by Catapult. So let's back up a bit and talk a little bit about why, how, and really why the book came about.
Sure. Well, really, it was... the book didn't exist, you know, and I think it was one of the rare times where I thought, huh, I think this book actually doesn't exist. There's a lot of resources, books, webinars, classes, obviously there's the entire MFA program to help prepare aspiring writers to get an agent and then hopefully get a book deal. I mean, truly, that is what the MFA is there for, right? Mm-hmm. You're learning to put together a collection, a poetry collection, short stories, a novel that's going to get you an agent, that's going to get you a book deal. But then what? Then nothing. One assumes that your agent and editor will guide you through the process. But, you know, I'm here to tell you with the 175 other people in my book that there's not that 101, you know, publishing 101 seminar. It didn't exist. Your agent, of course, can talk you through some things, but there is so much that's opaque and there's so much that's embarrassing. You know, if you start to feel these dark feelings of envy and jealousy, or you just hate your cover and your agent doesn't want to go to bat for it because they're scared of your editor. These conversations are not happening, you know, between your editor and your agent. And it becomes increasingly uncomfortable to talk things out with your own writer friends, because when you get a book deal, either you have friends who don't have agents yet and they're jealous, or you have friends who got better deals than you and they're getting their stuff adapted for film. And it just becomes this mire of uncomfortable feelings. Of course, there's a lot of positivity, but it really gets a bit ugly and squeamish. And most people, and I feel comfortable saying most people because I did so many interviews for this book, they just didn't know where to turn. And so they were going into private, you know, Google groups and Facebook groups, and great, but that shut so many out. So I wanted to write, you know, what I hope is sort of an exhaustive, definitive guide that leads people through, let's just, you know, say 2 years before book deal and then 2 years after your first book comes out, with the entire, you know, choose your own adventure series of what the eventual outcomes could be. We look at the successful routes, we look at the disasters, the things you never expected. I mean, I didn't get into pandemics, but I talked about, you know, if there's a national disaster during your launch week. And I wanted it to be the sort of your body, you know, our body, ourselves, you know, the thing as a young woman, like my mother hid that under my pillow and we never talked about it, but I read it in private and I felt that I had found answers I was too embarrassed to ask other people for. And I want this to be that book that you feel that you have a friend or even really an agent who just sits down with a martini and is like, I'm going to tell you all the dirty secrets and you'll know them all. Go share them with your friends. That's what I wanted the book to be.
Mm-hmm. Well, I like it for many reasons. I like that you've interviewed a lot of writers and agents. I like that you also talk about things that in books like this, well, there's really no book like this, but you know, in writing books, business books, you talk about poetry and how how poets can go about dealing with, you know, publication, which, you know, I thought it was really interesting and wonderful that you said, you know, go the contest route.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you. Yeah, I poets sort of, you know, they become like a joke during speeches at gala. People like, mm-hmm. like, oh, for the poets in the room. But poets are, I mean, they're writers, right? And they need to make a money. There's not, as well, more than novelists. I mean, you're not reading about the $1 million deals for poetry collections, right? mm-hmm. So I try to include everyone. The one area where we don't really get into in the book is children's book authors. Or aspiring children. I think that's the one, if we do a second edition, I need to include more there. But, you know, I tried to speak to some screenwriters in the book and essayists and comic writers. And there was a little bit about graphic memoirs. I tried to get it all in there. But, yeah, poets were front of mind for me, for sure.
That was great. And also, it's interesting that you've been published by, you know, the Big Five. You've also self-published. And yeah. I wonder if you could talk about that, because there seems to be such a
taboo.
A fight. Yeah, taboo about self-publishing. And in some cases, it's a good thing. It may not be,
definitely,
you know, the first way a person goes if they want to somehow get a novel out there, but I don't know. Talk about that.
Yeah, sure. I'm glad you asked me about that. People are sometimes shocked when I say that I'm pro self-publishing, but there's a time and a place. And if you have a piece of a project that you believe in with all of your heart, and you truly think that it's just a question of time until you find the right agent, it's never a good idea to self-publish that, because once you self-publish it, it with very few exceptions, it can't be picked up by a commercial publisher. They'll already consider it a published work. So your best bet, if you believe in your project, or that you believe it has commercial potential, I should say, is to hire an outside editor, you know, give it to outside readers, get it into the best shape you possibly can, just revise, and keep trying to get an agent for it. If you, and this is where I was in my early 20s, if you have something that you're just dying to share, you know, you don't need to get it into the review to the New York Times. You don't need money. You should never expect to get money as a writer, but you know, you're not doing it for sales. You just need people to understand that this book matters to you and that you identify as a writer. And you're also at a place emotionally where you can't handle a lot of feedback. You know, maybe it's a very sensitive topic, maybe it's a memoir. This happens a lot with memoirs. Or it's an ode to your grandfather or something very personal that might not have outside appeal. That is an excellent, excellent time to self-publish. With me, what had happened was my first book, I mentioned I got an agent for it and an editor, Doubleday, really quickly. And then that whole, everything fell apart. The editor left her job and no one else, there were 18 other editors at other houses. No one picked it up. And I was so devastated by that. I mean, I went through a couple of years of trying to write other books that would be more commercial. And I finally just started writing for myself again. And I got to a point where I had a collection of short stories. And I was smart enough, because like any writer, I'd been sending out work and had been, you know, accumulating rejections for years and years. So I was smart enough to recognize that this collection, while pretty good and in some places kind of great and in some places just terrible and lazy, that the stories didn't connect in a way that would make it saleable. But I just had, especially after the first book falling apart, or being orphaned, we could say, I had to have the object of a book with my name on. I had to. I felt that I could not go on if I didn't have a book. And so I worked with, so I thought, well, I'll just self-publish it. And I went with a little boutique press in Troy called Troy Bookmakers, which I highly, highly recommend, because they work, you know, with you. They're not bots or something. These are real people. You go in, you can look at covers and graphic design. It was really neat. And then they also set you up with bookstores around around the Albany area, which sort of extends into the Berkshires. And it was an amazing experience. And I decided, I vowed to myself I would only do 150 copies, and that when they were all gone, they were all gone, and I'd never print another one. And I was able to sell through or give away those 150, and I never looked back. But, you know, that sort of year around that book being in limited circulation and just hearing from friends and family, and it did end up in the hands of some people I didn't know, was all I needed to restore my confidence to a place where I worked on the novel that I knew had more commercial potential. It was a beautiful Band-Aid, and it was really, I don't have a single regret about that. It never posed a problem in my career because the stories weren't really good enough to be published elsewhere. Mm-hmm. But it was perfect. It was a perfect experience for me. And, you know, not everyone, their souls are not going to make it through the very difficult experience of being published. Mm-hmm. It can be really, really rough on your pride and your, I mean, I'm always astonished by the people who read their Amazon reviews or Goodreads reviews. I don't have the stomach for that.
Yeah.
You know, and it can be, of course, it's a privilege and it can be incredibly great, but even when it's great, it's rough. I mean, every day, all you have to do on Twitter is look at some amazing novelist. They're usually women. Whose reputation's being trashed. Mm-hmm. Why? Because people are bored. That's, a lot of people can't handle that. It would break them. Why not do it? Why not publish your very special thing in a quieter manner until you work up the resolve to share it in a larger way? Why not?
Yeah. Did you use that in the future when you were looking for an agent, or had it come up in any way?
No, I don't think, sort of never talked about it. It was like an affair. No, I didn't use it as leverage. I mean, again, I'm a pretty open-eyed person. I knew that this was not something to go bragging about, you know? Mm-hmm. So no, I don't recall using that. I mean, again, I got my first agent before any of this. Mm-hmm. And stayed with him for a while. And then by the time I moved on to a second agent, I had lots of other published work to talk about rather than my short story collection.
Sure. Well, in terms of stories and fiction writers, is it good to start with stories or go straight to a novel, do you think?
At this point in this market, it's probably better to start with a personal essay. Mm-hmm. That seems to be how a lot of people are getting book deals, is having some splashy personal essay in a publication, usually online, that gets a lot of eyeballs on it. And then usually agents will come out of the cracks, or even Hollywood agents, and they want to turn it into a movie. They want to turn it. Of course, this doesn't happen for everyone, right? This is a dream path, but it happens a lot, actually. So the short story's harder right now, especially with COVID, you know, we're closing a lot of magazines and whatnot. But certainly a short story is a great stepping stone to a novel. Maybe if you want to write a novel, maybe you don't want to. I mean, no one's going to argue that agents are dying for short story collections, mm-hmm. right? Most mm-hmm. agents take on short story collections because they think that the author has a novel in them. But that being said, you know, the last round of National Book Awards, quite a lot of the long list was dedicated to short story collections. Mm. I think it just comes down to quality, really.
Yeah. Well, also in that realm, is it happening much these days that novels are being optioned or short stories? Because writers, you know, they might be writing something and say, oh, this has filmic potential. Should I just write a screenplay instead? Right. Or you know, write the novel or write the story and hope that somehow it gets to a director or producer?
Gosh, how to answer that question. I mean, content is being optioned, that's for sure. All kinds of things are being optioned. Personal essays are being optioned. I mean, I know that like Mira Jacob, who She wrote the graphic memoir, Real Talk. That was optioned. I think she's actively working on adapting it for, I want to say television, but I could be speaking out of turn. I've had books optioned. I had a phone call today, more or less commissioning a novella, you know, that could potentially, the person thought that it could be optioned. I mean, I think everyone who has good ideas right now, they're all sort of running around like, how can we make this work? How can we earn some money in this very volatile industry? So everything can be optioned. Everything. There's Twitter feeds that become optioned, you know? And that's been the case for a long time. I'm reading right now Vanity Fair Diaries by Tina Brown, and it's very interesting to be in the head of a powerful editor and hear about, you know, she was relating this conversation with an author during dinner, and she was thinking, I want him to write that article so that it can be optioned. You know, some people can work that way. Some people cannot, you know. I did a panel this, gosh, it seems like 19 years ago, but it was this winter with someone who writes treatments first. He writes the treatments for books, and then the treatment gets optioned. A treatment is like an outline, and the treatment gets optioned, and then he goes back and writes the actual book so that the book can be optioned, so that each time he's getting a lot more money when the movie finally comes out. Mm. He has, and I think that's very savvy. I don't think I could work that way, you know, but one could certainly try. You need to be an incredibly prolific on-demand writer in order to put the cart before the horse that way. But people work like that, sure. Hmm.
You know? So we have a few minutes left, and I want to talk about query letters, because you go into query letters quite a bit in this book, which is a great thing because it's sort of the front gate to getting an agent. Can you say a little bit about query letters and whether it helps to say you can get authors to blurb your book once it comes out, or is that seen as hype?
Interesting question. That's a good question. So query letters, I think you're right. They are sort of the red rope, right? And most creative people, most artists cannot write about their own work well. So it's the rare writer who can write a good query. I actually have a little service called the Query Doula, where I help people with their queries, and you'd be amazing how, I mean, you'd be amazed how, actually you wouldn't be astonished how often writers bury the most interesting things about their own work and themselves because they just feel that it would be boastful or embarrassing or I don't know what. So query letters, I mean, we're in a brave new world now, so the query should not, this is my personal opinion, it's how I go about it. I don't think that they should, that their job is only to try to garner interest in the manuscript you're hoping to be invited to attach, mm-hmm. right? You also want to drum up interest in you as a, forgive me for saying this, as a brand that can be developed and supported over the life cycle of your career. But by that, I mean, obviously, if you've had nothing published, you're not going to send some letter about this will be my first book and my second book will be this, my third book will be this. But I do think around the fourth paragraph when you're writing your bio, there should be some tie-in that shows how you could support this book in the wild if it were to be published. So I'm going to give an example. I have permission to share this example. I was working with a writer who is trying to publish a book about a novel about the internment of Italian fishermen during World War II, which is a really interesting topic I wasn't aware of. The Navy was confiscating their boats. And in her bio, so she lives in the Midwest, she's landlocked. And in her bio, she had some nice bylines, but absolutely nothing that tied into, you know, the maritime industry or the sea or anything like that. And talking to her on the phone, she told me about that, how fishing with her dad was this amazing experience of her life. He was very busy. It was like the only time on Sundays where they could be together. And I said, let's find a way to work that into the body, you know, so we understand why this love of the sea and fishing and fishermen And because what an agent will get from that is, oh man, this would be an incredible personal essay to place in Oprah for Father's Day, you know? Mm-hmm. So again, it's a tough little dance you have to do, because when you're starting out, you don't want to be boastful, but you do want to have the professionalism to say, I am someone capable of doing the hard work necessary to promote my book out in the world, you know? And so if you have, for example, a huge social media following, you mentioned that. If you have a blog that has a really strong audience in a specific region, you know, the Midwest, the South, mention that. If you wrote the book about ballet because your sister was a ballerina and you always, then write about that. Just mention it. You know, anything that will make the agent sit up and think, huh, there's a life beyond this book. It's not just this one book. This person is sort of bankable and saleable. And, you know, it's not pleasant to talk about artists in that way, but this is how the game works. So, and then you asked me about whether or not, yeah, the connections thing. Whether or not at the end of the query you say, I think I could get my book blurbed by so-and-so. Mm-hmm. To me, if you're going to pull those strings, I think it's better to pull those strings to get an actual introduction to an agent. You know, mm-hmm. Dear Maria, I'm writing you because my novelist friend, Julia Phillips, is represented by you and thinks that blah, blah, blah. Do you see what I mean? Right. I wouldn't, it seems a bit, I think that dangling those carrots, dangle them when you're trying to get an editor, not an agent. But mm-hmm. That's my personal opinion, and I'm sure that people would disagree, but it seems a bit early.
Yeah.
Talk about blurbs.
Well, also in the query letter, would you mention how long your book is? And part two of that question is, what is the hoped for length of novels and memoirs?
Yeah, I tell people, again, this is my opinion, mm-hmm. but I tell people if it's over 90,000 words to not mention the length in the query letter. A hoped for length, I mean, people are starting to read shorter. My Costa Alegre was only about 50,000 words. I think in the 80 range up to 90, something like that. That's like your typical commercial novel is falls there. But these days, anything between, I'd say, 50 and, you know, 90 is being considered a novel. I would keep it a deep, dark secret if your manuscript is 170,000 words. Mm-hmm. Let them fall in love with it. That's going to scare people away, for sure. Especially right now, the attention spans are getting shorter and shorter. That doesn't mean if you have a huge book plan that you shouldn't write it, because quality content is the exception. People make exceptions. There's tons of doorstopper books that have come out that are absolutely incredible and their length is completely justified. You know, but you don't want to lead with, you know, please find attached my 230,000 word, you know, first in the series, so on and so on. They'll scream, they'll run away.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, something else I like about your book, I like getting it represented in that chapter. You have Rebecca Mackay, a quote by her that says, if you're 100% happy with your manuscript, it's probably a sign that it's bad.
Yep.
Talk about that.
Oh, God. Yeah. I have so many people I work with, and their initial contact with me is, I don't need to hire you because actually my query letter is great mm-hmm. and my book is great. And it's just never true, unfortunately.
Yeah, it does. You know, it does seem to be. I mean, I find this with my students that the ones that are hardest on themselves tend to be the better writers.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
And those that are like, you know what, I'm there, you know, thanks for reading this. I don't really need any feedback. And you know.
No, I mean, I think the way I think about it and the way I think about Rebecca's quote is that if you're faced with someone who thinks that, you know, their book length project is perfect, then you're faced with someone who doesn't understand the way that publishing works, because you have to recognize that there's critics, there's going to be a lot of people who don't like your book, there'll be a lot of people who love it. All you have to do is be an author who goes to a book club And, you know, there's seven people and four of them are frowning. They didn't like it, you know? And so I do think that recognizing that your manuscript is as awesome as you could possibly make it, and that now you need some professional help, that's sort of the winning attitude, because you're going to get help whether or not you want it. Right. You know, I mean, after you've been courted by an editor, the remaining 9 months of your time together is just them saying, what's wrong with your book? Actually, you have to do developmental edits. So you cannot win in this industry if you think everything you do is great and doesn't need edits. It's just that then you need to self-publish, because it just doesn't work that way. It doesn't work that way.
Mm-hmm. Well, what you just said, you know, at a book club, four of them are frowning. Something else I wanted to talk about was you in the book, you talk about engaging the naysayers. And I was thinking about that too, because my students and I are doing our annual class reading on Zoom on Sunday. And when I asked them if they'd invited people, many said that they told their family and friends and they didn't get much reaction.
Yeah.
So, you know, they're like, what's the deal? This is my reading. Why aren't they interested? So can you talk a little bit about how to understand when people don't react to even your publishing success?
Oh, God. I mean, welcome to my life. My mother recently, this summer, was out. She came out because I was going on book tour. And she just didn't say anything about my new book. And I said to her, you know, did you like, you realize I have a book out today? She goes, you do? She didn't even, she just like forgotten. I mean, listen, my husband's a filmmaker and I watched this interesting thing happen over and over again. We will go to dinner party. I mean, in the old world, right? We would go to dinner parties, cocktails, and strangers would come up to him and say things about his first film in a way where like, they felt so comfortable to talk to him. And perhaps it's a problem with me and like my personality, I don't know. But that happens very rarely to me. And in having been married to a filmmaker for a long time, I think it's because I talk about this in the book. With a film, there's so many elements, like there was the, you can talk about the costumes, you can talk about the sound design, the soundtrack, the acting, the cinematography, on and on and on, the setting, you know? And it's not just you and the words you wrote on the page. Mm-hmm. There's so many different ways to enter a conversation with a filmmaker. And even maybe with an artist, but I haven't thought through that. But whereas with an author, it's just you and the author. What are you going to talk about? Typography? Are you copy edits? I mean, there's not. And a lot of people do not know how to talk to writers about their work. And it doesn't help that most writers are incredibly defensive egomaniacs, myself included, you know? So often it just doesn't go well. And I mean, in the case of my family, they're not even readers, my relatives. They're not readers. They don't know how to talk about books. They're not in book clubs. They're not, you know, they read the papers, but they read news and they digest it and they go about their day. They're not critical thinkers. So, you know, I think
I want
the extent of a conversation I've had with my family, sort of with my stepmother, she remember her saying something like, oh, I think this will be a big one. You'll get on Ellen DeGeneres or something. I didn't. Yeah.
Yeah. But, well, do you think it's also that more people are watching films than reading books? And so it's easier to talk to your husband about the film than to talk to you about the book?
Maybe it's true that a lot of really good online writing is about television and a lot of the debates on Twitter about television. But no, I think this is a cultural, it's culturally embedded problem. I mean, literary criticism has never really, you know, people aren't falling all over themselves to subscribe to, like,
yeah.
You know, I don't want to put anyone down, but it's hard to get people all excited about reading book reviews.
Right.
I mean, even among my most well-read friends, I find that we have to push ourselves to talk about books. Mm-hmm. People sort of read them and have the kind of 4-star mentality. Oh, that's a 4-star. That's a 3-star. That's right. a 2-star. And they move mm-hmm. on. And that's a problem. And I think that that problem leaches into the way that we think about books. We think of them as debutantes, really, mm-hmm. who dance across the stage. They have their 15 minutes of fame, and then we want the next hot thing. Mm-hmm. Whereas I'm a big believer in the backlist and dream of a world where we have literary festivals and podcasts dedicated to backlists so that we can remind readers the worth of discovering books they haven't read instead of the thing on the summer list, you know, the 10 hot books you have to read. I think that stems from just, we're not a culture that values literary criticism. We don't know how to talk about books.
Mm. Yeah, even in book clubs at times, you know, the talk is, you know, very little about books and very much about, you know, TV, film, food.
Yeah.
You know, everything else. So it is interesting.
I mean, my husband's French, and I will say, having lived there, in France, they really know how to talk about books. This is a part, I've been at dinners where people from all walks of life just start debating books in a way, like heated debates, you know, and they're bringing in other references and allusions, and it's like a cliche of like an intellectual, I don't know, it's really much more part of the culture. They have this incredible program called the Le Masque et la Plume. I mean, can you imagine the show doing well in America? It's about theater. They like take down theater and writing. They talk about books, theater, and once in a while film, but mostly it's books and theater. And they just sit there for an hour. I think the program's an hour, and talk about theater and books. And they're not like these, you know, 6-minute interviews that, because of course we have wonderful programs in America dedicated to books. Of course we do. But, you know, not everyone is David Naiman. David Naiman has between the books that 1.5 hours that just talking to an author about what they've written and what their influences are. It's an incredible podcast. I just think it's an amazing show. And it's so entertaining, because what we're missing by not having these long, long conversations is getting past the sound bites, you know? Mm-hmm. And when you start to break an author down, plus they start to get tired and they start saying things they shouldn't. It's a great show.
You get to all the good stuff.
Totally.
Well, I wish we had more time. It's been great having you on. And you've written a great book, and you've done a great service for writers. And, you know, I wish you the best of luck with this.
Thank you very much. And I wish you luck as well. And I wish all of our listeners good luck, not just with their writing, but with their lives right now, because things are complicated.
Things are complicated. Thank you, Courtney.
Thank you.
You have been listening to Writers on Writing. I've been with Courtney Maum. Her book is Before and After the Book Deal, A Writer's Guide to Finishing, Publishing, Promoting, and Surviving Your First Book. Thank you for listening, and we'll be here next week too, so come on back.